This is United Tribes News Radio, insights into Native culture, people, ideas, topics to improve understanding from United Tribes Technical College in Bismarck. It was the early 70s, and 17-year-old Hattie Kaufman was beginning to make history in radio broadcasting. She didn't realize it at the time, but that first opportunity as a college radio reporter would open many doors in broadcasting industry, not only for her, but for Native Americans in news. Hattie is also Native American. Life for Hattie was a struggle, from her upbringing with alcoholic parents, to struggling to live with seven siblings on the Nez Perce Reservation in Idaho, and eventually onto the projects of Seattle, to learning to survive in a house with no electricity or water. She attributes her survival skills and her ability to tell a story to her success as a reporter. Though her broadcasting career started in radio, Kaufman was the first Native American to report on major network television news, most notably a television news correspondent for ABC's Good Morning America and CBS Evening News. She recently wrote her first book, Falling Into Place, and is already starting on her second book. Here's Ms. Kaufman's story, in her words, speaking at a book signing on the campus of United Tribes Technical College.
Hi, everybody. It's kind of odd to be holding one of these microphones. I feel like I'm reporting for CBS News or ABC or King 5, which is where I started in Seattle. It's really great to be at UTTC. I've been a longtime supporter of the tribal colleges and the American Indian College Fund. I used to MC the gala, the Flame of Hope gala in New York and in Denver and in Minneapolis that raised money for tribal colleges and for scholarships. And so I'm familiar with UTTC. I was really hoping I could meet the basketball players that went 2-on-5. I mean, amazing. And that made it onto ESPN. I tweeted about it, you know, UTTC. I mean, the big athlete news came right from here. I'm just thrilled, yes. Yay for those guys. I've also really thought that it was a wonderful thing that there is men's basketball, because I know that a lot of tribal colleges, the majority student or the typical student is a woman who's older and has kids. And I want to get some young men to come to college too, so I'm just thrilled that you have a basketball program here. So I do know something about the place. I started at University of Minnesota, and that was so, I'm so old. She's got these dinosaur buttons, and I'm like, oh, I'm a dinosaur. Because I was a freshman in 1972. I mean, I talked this morning at University of Mary, and there were three classes that gathered together, and I realized when I said that, like, they weren't born in the 70s. They weren't born in the 80s. You know, these are kids that were born in the 90s. So, anyway, but I was a freshman there at U of M, and 17 years old, we had something called ASA, the American Indian Student Association, and we were sitting there in a room, you know, with the leftover furniture that was gathered from other rooms, and tough as nails, us students, in our green army jackets and, you know, red bandana tied on and fringe and just like, you know, looking mean as can be. And in came somebody from the radio station saying, there's a lot of Indian news. We'd like to give you guys 5 minutes a day for Indian news on the radio. Now think about that. That would never happen today. You wouldn't say, let's go to our African American news report, you know, our Chinese news. But then in 1972 in Minnesota, somebody got the idea it was a good idea to have 5 minutes of Indian news. And I was 17, sitting there thinking, surely one of these older students is going to take it, because they offered to pay you 2.5 hours a day to put on 5 minutes. And I thought, I could do that in 5 minutes, you know. So my hand went up. And I was only 17, but I volunteered. And because I volunteered, right away, I had a little tape recorder, and I was out interviewing Russell Means, Dennis Banks, Clyde Belcourt, Vernon Belcourt. I was out covering AIM, and this was just, I started in 72, so it was before the takeover of Wounded Knee in 73. This news made national news, and also they weren't talking, they weren't giving interviews to everybody, but here I come with my long hair, my eagle feather tied to my hair, and my, like, you know, I looked like I wasn't going to be very objective. And so they gave me the interviews, and my interviews got picked up and got played beyond just the little radio station of the University of Minnesota. And one day, somebody from WCCO, which is the CBS affiliate in Minneapolis, heard me on the radio. You know, and what happenstance is that? You know, just picture this guy gets in his car and turns it on, and there's India News. I mean, it's like one of those odd little coincidences. But he heard it, and they were just starting a minorities in broadcasting program, a scholarship program, and he called and offered me a scholarship. So I'm really grateful that I could be here with you. I wish there were more actual students in here, because I always want to tell the students that you never know what's going to happen when you raise your hand and volunteer. Because that was 1972. I retired from CBS in 2012. So 40 years of broadcasting. Had no idea that there were no other Native American network news correspondents. Had no idea that someday I would break a barrier. When I did a story for World News Tonight with Peter Jennings about an airplane that had taken off from Hawaii and the fuselage peeled back like a banana and all the people were sitting there with their hair flying, you know, because it was an incredible story, and the airplane turned around and landed again. And I happened to be there, you know, and once again, I'll do it. I'll do that story, and because they didn't have time to fly somebody from New York or even from LA to go to Hawaii, do this story and put it on that night's evening news. But I happened to be there, and so I did it. And because I did it and went on television that night on ABC World News Tonight with Peter Jennings, it was the first time that a Native American had ever reported on the evening news. And it's actually in, that little marker is actually in a museum in Washington, D.C. There's a museum dedicated to news called the Newseum. And clever. And on the third floor, in the little corner, there's a little Hattie Kaufman thing, because it's about firsts, like the first woman, the first African American, whatever. And there's a little first Native American. And all it came about was just, you know, saying, I'll do it, and I'll be there. I'll try, even though I didn't really know how. And so many times in my life, stepping out on faith, stepping out when you're just going to just try. I shared a little earlier that one of the things that makes this career that I've chosen so tough is that everybody's competing to be on TV. You know, you've seen those movies like Ron Burgundy. It's real. It's like, I'm the star. No, I'm the star. I'm the star. No, I'm the star. And that was what it was like. And sort of elbowing each other and trying to get the assignment. Not only trying to be the one to get the news assignment, but get the big news assignment, and then trying to be the one that becomes the anchor, and then trying to be the one that goes to the network. And so it was always a very competitive business. And I was it's particularly with Native American groups, I try to share this, that we're storytellers. That's the culture, that's tradition. And being a reporter, is all you're doing is telling the story. That's all you're supposed to do. You witness history, you turn around, and you tell what happened. And that's it. I knew one reporter who was, I actually am so old that I worked before there were live trucks and live shots. So at the beginning, nobody was live. And then once the first live truck came within the newsroom, somebody who was able to do it and not freak out was, okay, if it's going to be live, it's going to be him. You know, because everybody else might freak out or get scared. Excuse me. There was one guy who was doing a live shot about something. I don't remember what his story was, but this was Seattle. And so behind him, there's water. And he's telling whatever he's telling. And a boat happens to blow its horn. And he's in the middle of saying, you know, today the city council, and went, and he turned around, and they looked back, and they went, because he forgot. You know, he had memorized, I'm going to say, today the city council, and when the boat distracted him, he turned around, and that look on his face, because he absolutely forgot his lines. He had memorized lines. And I learned right away, you don't memorize lines. All you're doing is telling somebody. And the way not to get freaked out and the way not to get scared is to think of this as this and the camera lens as a telephone, and you're calling home and you're telling mom or you're telling your aunt what happened. And that's all. That way you don't have to get scared that you're going to lose your place, or it has to be 15 seconds or whatever. You're just telling people. And so my career for my 25, 30 years was telling people what I saw. And it was a crazy life. A network news correspondent you would travel with a suitcase. I had a packed suitcase in my car, a packed suitcase under my desk, and a packed suitcase at home. And each one had cold clothes and warm clothes. One time I was in New York, and one of the bosses said, there's been an earthquake in Mexico City, head to the airport. And I said, okay, wait, I'm going to stop at my apartment and get my passport. And he said, forget it. And he went to somebody else. You know, so I learned, keep your passport on you, your makeup, your everything. In a given moment, you're flying out the door. And you never know when you're going to come back. It could be gone once. I was in L.A. when there was news of this boy hanging on to an inner tube washed up in Miami. Is this ringing a bell? This was in the early 90s, or late 90s. This was Elian Gonzalez. He and his mother, where they tried to escape from Cuba. The mother drowned, and the little boy washes up on Thanksgiving Day. You know, and I'm in L.A., and for some reason they say, go to Miami. And I didn't come back for weeks, because that story went on for weeks. You end up having to go and buy some clothes and buy some toothpaste, and but the life of being a network news correspondent is one where you just have no clue of what's going to happen next and when you're going to come home. I tell people that if you were a kid who likes field trips in school, it's just like that. It's a field trip in school. Every day is a field trip. The only thing is, there's no teacher coming along. You don't know where you're going. You don't know when you're going to come back. Just be packed and be ready. So that was it. And it kind of worked for me. I realize now, as I said, Native American, half American Indian, half white, grew up in Seattle. My family left the reservation. We're at Nez Perce. And so there, you know, like the biggest city, well, you could go to Spokane or you can go to Seattle. And they moved to Seattle. And they were drinking, they were fighting, their marriage broke up, we were in the projects, we were seven kids, and they were gone a lot. And so we were home a lot alone. And seven kids alone, if there's nobody, you know, opening the bills don't get paid. And so utilities get shut off, and the lights would be shut off, or the gas would be shut off, and then we were cold. Even one day the water was shut off. And we had to figure out how to get by. And when I think about my career now as a network news correspondent, a lot of the survival skills, you know, that elbowing, I got to get mine, I'm going to figure this out, came about because of that childhood. When you think of, we didn't know what was going to happen next. As a network news correspondent, you don't know what's going to happen next. You don't know where you're going to be sent. You don't know where you're going to be in this hotel. You're going to come home in 2 days or in 5 days. You don't know. And I grew up with that not knowing. And also, another parallel that I realized is that there was a lot of stress in this childhood. You know, when there's drinking, part of growing up with alcoholic adults is nothing makes sense. So simple things like the light bulb is out, somebody buy a new light bulb, doesn't happen. It just, for, you know, like 5 years, that room's dark. Because the simple things just, it's mind-boggling. But you learn to adapt, and we learned to adapt, and I think all that adaptation helped me as I started in this business and realized that you're really flying at the seat of your pants most of the time, because you don't know what your story is going to be, where you're flying, when you're coming home, what you're, you know, even if you think you're covering this, all of a sudden it's that. You could be midway. So many times I was on the way to the airport, and it's never mind. You know, never mind. It's kind of a wild life, and it's a life that you end up giving yourself to until it's done, or until, you know, forever how long. And there are sacrifices, but there are great rewards that came with it as well. One of the things that I learned most of all is that every person that you're interviewing, whether it is somebody behind bars in Angola. I've been in several prisons, but Angola is where a lot of lifers are, and they're not coming out. They're never going home. There is a graveyard. There are old, old people, like geriatric care for prisoners, because they're never getting out. And to interview somebody that's never going to be, you know, see freedom again, and then to interview, then to be on the red carpet and interviewing the Oscar winners at Oscar night, and then to be backstage at the Grammys and interviewing somebody who's still sweaty who just came off from their performance and they're all, you know, jazzed and excited. I learned that we are all people who are going through something, and it helped me get a better understanding that I could, that helped me tell their stories. One of the ones I remember most was I was assigned to cover the 30,000 people who live in a ring around the garbage dump of Mexico City. It was one of my first international assignments. I was working for Good Morning America at the time. And, you know, think about it. We came from New York. We flew into Mexico City. We got these Lincoln Town cars, and we're driving up. And it was kind of crazy, even a caravan of cars, because the sound man had his own car. The cameraman had his own car. You know, we came from this world that is not at all like living around the dump. On what can you scavenge from the garbage dump? Maybe that's just some nails you can sell or a piece of tarp or something. So we get out of our rental cars, and these little kids come running up, and their skinny little brown legs and skinny arms, and they're going like this for food. And I didn't think to bring food or buy water. Didn't even cross my mind that we should do such a thing. And they're all, oh, I looked around my pocket. All I had was a little package of airplane peanuts. That's all. And I open it, and they split it, and they're like, they're all tearing into it. It was just a horrifying experience. And I had thought we had grown up poor. The producer says, I've got an idea. Let's ask everybody what's the most valuable thing you own, and then we'll do a video montage and just, like, show them the things, you know? And it kind of struck me wrong. I didn't really like that idea because it seemed it could be demeaning. Like, what's the most valuable thing you own? What's the most valuable thing you own? It didn't seem right. So I'm sitting across from a woman. I'm interviewing her, and I ask her where she came from. What was her village? How long has she been at the garbage dump of Mexico City? Why did she come here? What was she hoping for? And then I thank you, gracias, señora. And then over my shoulder comes the voice of my producer who says, un momento. One question more. What is the most valuable thing you own? She looked at him and then looked at me and looked at us in our, like, New York clothes. And her kids are running around barefoot on broken glass, and it's disgusting and stinky. And it's not even a house she lives in, but it's just something leaning against something else. And she drew herself up and she said, mi familia, mi familia. And in that instant, I knew I'm the same as this woman who lives by scavenging at the garbage dump. And that has helped me and served me. Luckily, that was one of my first international stories. It helped serve me so that no matter whether I'm interviewing a star backstage at, you know, one of the award shows or interviewing somebody in Angola, there are some universals, mi familia, who we are, what we do, what we try to do. It helped me not get starstruck, because they're just somebody. And it also helped me not look down, because they're just somebody like I'm somebody. So that has been my long career in television, and I really like encouraging college students all over America to do the thing I did at age 17, to volunteer when somebody said, we want to put on this little program of Indian news at the University of Minnesota, and I raised my hand. If I hadn't raised my hand and just volunteered, I wouldn't have had the chance to run out and interview Dennis Banks and Russell Means. That led to a scholarship, that led to the next door opening, and the next door opening that led to this, you know, breaking the barrier, becoming the first Native American network news correspondent. Especially at this age here at UTTC and at University of Mary, where I spoke this morning, it's just people at this time in life when it's possible to open those big doors. Not that it's never impossible, but at that time, you can change the trajectory of your life. As I said, this is such a great time in the lives of young people where you can explore so many opportunities during your college age. And I was sort of just, you know, young and tough and wanted to do everything. Every class I took, I thought, I could do this. I remember taking a human physiology class and thinking, I could be a doctor. I could, you know, no matter what it was, political science, I thought, are there any Native Americans in Congress? You know, everything, no matter what. And so I was about in my third year when I learned that in the state of Minnesota, there was only one Native American certified to teach. And I thought, this is wrong. There are 11 reservations here, and I'm going to fix that. And I walked into the College of Education, to the dean's office, and demanded they let me in. And they did. You know, so my undergraduate is actually in education. And it wasn't until like 3 years of teaching when I thought, I wonder if that scholarship is still available in journalism, because teaching's hard. Yeah, and not that journalism isn't hard, but I was kind of lonely for adult conversation. And so I went back to WCCO, the one that had told me they were offering a scholarship, and they said, reapply. And so I switched. I have shared, however, that, you know, growing up in this home where we were very poor and where the lights would get shut off and where, you know, because people were drinking, you didn't know what was going to happen at 2 a.m., like who's going to come rolling in the door and all of that, that as a little kid, I was always seeking the answers to what, as reporters, we are taught to ask, who, what, when, where, why. And as a little kid, I wanted to know who's going to take care of us. What are we going to do? When's mom coming home? Where are they? Why are they drinking? You know, so it's interesting to me that I grew up as a seeker of information when as a little kid I was a seeker of information. So I actually think some of what we went through, those really hard times, and I try to share this when I speak to particularly Native American groups or any groups anywhere, and it doesn't have to be Native American, it have to go through hard times. It can make you stronger. I had a book signing in Dallas. I had book signings all over America when my book first came out, but I was at a Barnes & Noble in Dallas, and it was kind of slow. You know, there's nobody coming around. And I'm thinking about bagging it, and maybe, you know, it's happened. There were people, but there's nobody right now. And there's this one guy walking around, a white guy, 20s maybe, overweight, with an orange mohawk and cargo shorts, and I'm, you know, and I'm thinking, is he going to buy a middle-aged woman's book, Native American poor, you know? Anyway, he comes over, and we're sort of eyeing each other because we're like the only people in this empty Barnes & Noble. And eventually, he comes by and he goes, so what's your book about? And I said, you know, because it's, where do you start? What's your book about? I mean, it's about a lot of things. And I said, well, I grew up really poor in the projects. One of 7 kids, my parents were drinking, and he said, I was a human shield for my little brother to protect him from my mom on meth. And it gave me chills because there we were connecting, just like I connected with that woman at the garbage dump in Mexico City. I connected with this guy with the orange mohawk, and he told me his story, you know, and he had come to faith too. And at the end, we actually stood up and we hugged each other at the Barnes & Noble. So, you know, that's why I say it doesn't have to be a Native American audience. I think there are some universal themes of the worst that you've been through, even in that, you're taken care of, you're cared for, and that you can take something from that, and not only to help yourself, but it might help somebody else. I mean, that's why I wrote my book. When I was working in television in New York, you know, I would never even tell somebody any of this. I hid all this. One time I was with a very famous, if I said his name, you would know his name, a male television anchor network. And he said, where were you born? And I said, Idaho. And he goes, no one's born in Idaho. And he got up and walked away. So I wasn't going to say, and we were poor. You know, I didn't want to say that. Because you kind of, no, there were people who worked who didn't have to work, you know, who had homes in the Hamptons as well as on Fifth Avenue in Manhattan, who would come in just because it's a glamorous profession, not because I need the job. And for me, my clawing up had always been, I need the job. Even when, you know, I had enough money and I probably didn't need to do that, I felt like it. When you grow up with something like that, it always feels like inside the lights are going to go out, the water's going to get shut off. There's several cardinal rules about being a reporter, but one of them is, if you want to succeed and you want to make your way up, you never say no to an assignment. I mean, you know, we want to send you to a town that's all been evacuated because of a chemical spill. Okay. You know, because if you say no, someone else is ready to jump in, and, you know, it's such a competitive thing. But as I got older in my career, there came sometimes one or twice when I said, no, I don't want to do that. So it came eventually. I think I'm happy where I am. I'm happy to be retired. I wouldn't want to have to go out and cover things that are happening today. I came from the old school. I'm a reporter. And then there's the producer who also is with me on the story. And the producer would know all the things that we're going to do, and the producer would, you know, have their own vision of how it's going to be put together. And there would be a photographer and then a separate person just doing sound, who's got the big furry boom mic and the headsets, and they're doing levels, and they're getting, like, if we had a sound person, they would say, let's turn off the air conditioning, I can hear that. And then sometimes at some networks, you'd also have a lighting director who would come, and they would be like setting up. So you'd have all these people, and many of them, not the on-camera person, but many of the technical people were all on the union. And so it would be union wages, and they could, if they went longer than 4 hours, they're into overtime because they skipped lunch. If you got a call, if you called the cameraman at home and said, we're flying to Denver, for the minute he gets the call, he's on the clock. So sometimes, before we've even landed, he's in OT. So it was very expensive. Driving to the airport, he's on the clock. You know, packing up, unpacking the gear in the hotel room, he's on the clock. And so it got very expensive. And then today, you can get, you know how people shoot on their iPhones? Everything's gotten smaller and smaller. And so the one-man band, the video journalist that he's talking about, today they are hiring people out of college who do everything. They have a little tiny camera, they shoot. They're doing the audio. They're looking at what the picture is instead of just the interview, but what's behind them. And then they turn the camera around and they talk to the camera. And then they take a little disc out of the camera and they put it in their laptop and they edit it. So they're an editor, a sound person, a photographer, a lighting person, a talent, and a producer. It's like six human beings that they, and not union, and you get them right out of college, and so everybody's eager. It's just, it's hard. So, and they end up getting burnt out. They work, and the networks and TV stations pay them not much money, and they work for a few years and get burnt out because it's hard work. I don't think I could do it. If I tried to go back to work today, I would have to do that because that's what you have to do. And major markets, Washington, D.C., Los Angeles, everybody's doing that. But I have been flying around doing lots of speaking for different groups, mostly college age, but trying to inspire students to keep going on. I'm starting to work on my second book. I'm semi-retired. I don't know how I did life before, because it's so hard when you're flying around. And so now I'm just kind of enjoying life. I mean, I was actually baking a pie the other day, and I'm rolling out the dough in my kitchen, and I thought, I get to finish this. Because the old days, it was so hard to start something because the pager, the thing, like, just go. At any second, go, and you don't know if you're going to come back next week or in 2 days, or you'd be racing to LAX. They'd say, never mind. And you, like, it was such a hard thing. So I'm just really enjoying life. I have two children who are both married and have kids, so I actually have grandkids. And I have a husband who's a later marriage in life husband, and we live in Seattle now. And I my story is set in Seattle, as a little kid, so it was perfect to move there and do my book. And I was a single or divorced parent for most of the time with my kids. And if you ask, I mean, I heard my son once say, we grew up in an edit room. And I thought, oh. But I would take them with me, you know. And then somebody asked, I heard my daughter describe her life, and it was rags to riches. And, you know, because when I first started out, it was hard. I am a single parent, but it was a well-paying career, and they went to prep schools, and they went to college, and they reaped benefits from my work, but there were big sacrifices in terms of time not spent together. But I encourage people to consider, particularly Native American young people, because it is storytelling, and that's, it's basically all it is. At its purest, you're just telling what happened. And I wish that more journalists today would just do that and not put the spin on it. Thank you all for coming out. Yeah. Appreciate it.
This program was produced by United Tribes Technical College, Office of Public Information. Dennis Newman, director. Alicia Heglin-Thorpe, producer. This series is designed not only to strengthen our communities, but to give insight and understanding of a tribal culture and a Native people. For more information, visit our website, UTTC.edu.